The military and political leaders of World War II were all white males with the attendant attitudes characteristic of their gender at the time. A woman's place was not in the military. However, a manpower shortage and some clever, visionary women forced them to correct their myopia. A famous woman pilot of the era, Jacqueline Cochran, persuaded the legendary Army Air Corps General Henry Hap Arnold that if women were permitted to handle the domestic flying duties, he could send more male pilots into combat overseas. A few women were already working as military ferry pilots, shuttling planes from base to base or from factory to training site. General Arnold decided to expand the operation, so he authorized the formation of the WASPs, the Women's Air Force Service Pilots. More than 25,000 women applied, and the requirements were tough. Candidates had to have a pilot's license and a minimum of 200 hours in the cockpit. They had to pass rigorous physicals and to submit to a series of interviews. In the end, only 1,000 were accepted and assigned to Army Air Force bases around the country. They received their orders through the military chain of command, but technically they were civilians. So when the war ended, they received no veterans' benefits, even though 38 of them died in the line of duty. Margaret Ray Ringenberg of Hoagland, Indiana, was an original WASP. She was raised on a farm, but at the age of 7, she had an experience that changed her life. We were going for a ride south of Fort Wayne when we saw a small plane landing in a field. My dad was a curious type, so we approached the pilot, and he offered us a ride. My mother said, no, she was sure that we were going to die. But when we all crawled in, she did too. I remember the instruments on the panel. I was fascinated. I decided I had to fly, but I thought I couldn't be a pilot because I was a girl, so I decided to become a stewardess. When Margaret graduated from high school, she had a change of heart about becoming a stewardess because she didn't want to go through nurses' training, which was required for flight attendants at the time. She went back to her original goal. She wanted to fly. In 1940, she started taking lessons at the local airfield and earned her license by the time she was 21, just in time for the Army Air Force to recruit her for the WASPs. I was flabbergasted, she remembers. What an opportunity. My father said, I didn't get to serve and I don't have any boys, so I guess you'll have to do it. After 6 months of rigorous training in a wide variety of military aircraft in Sweetwater, Texas, Margaret was sent to Wilmington, Delaware, to the 2nd Fairing Division, assigned to testing and transporting the planes used to train young men for combat flying. I was a co-pilot on the bigger planes because I was only 5'5", and you had to be 5'6" to be a pilot. It was very exciting and very demanding. We worked 7 days a week, sun up to sundown, but only when the weather was good because some of the planes didn't have radios yet. We'd fly a plane to Kansas, for example, turn right around and come back for a few hours' sleep before heading out again. She flew the PT-19, a single-engine, open-cockpit training plane, the AT-6, an advanced training plane, the C-45, a small passenger and light cargo plane, and as co-pilot on the B-24 and four-engine C-54, many of them right off the assembly line. At first, the male pilots didn't know what to think about this invasion of their territory. Somehow word got around that these were a bunch of rich women who were taking the safer domestic flying jobs, forcing more men into the line of fire overseas. The latter half of the rumor was true. But these were no privileged princesses of the air. They were crack pilots, and at $1,800 a year, they were underpaid and underappreciated. Their mission was often dangerous. Some of the WASPs piloted radio-controlled low-target planes. They sat in the cockpit while a mothership guided the target plane through a series of low-level maneuvers by radio control. If the radio signals failed, they were there to take the controls. Other WASPs towed targets for anti-aircraft batteries and airborne gunners to shoot at, often with live ammunition. More than once, a WASP pilot returned to the base with more bullet holes in her plane than in the target. Margaret, or Maggie as she was called then, had a harrowing experience ferrying a worn-out plane to the boneyard, a remote airfield where aircraft with too many hours on them were parked. She lost an engine and radioed her superiors with that information. She was told to get out, to parachute to safety. Maggie knew getting out of the cockpit was a difficult proposition. Besides, she was confident she could nurse the plane down. It was a tense but successful landing. Everyone was full of praise, except the commanding officer who had ordered her to bail out. He chewed her out for not following his orders. When a WASP died in the line of duty, there were no military honors, even though they were performing vital and dangerous military assignments. As civilians, they did have the option of resigning, but few did. In fact, more than 900 were still flying when the Army decided in December 1944 that it no longer needed their services. The combat ranks were full, and the manufacturing of new military aircraft was dropping off. The WASPs were told to go home. Maggie couldn't believe what was happening to her. Here I was, this farm girl with this new life, and it was so exciting. And now I'm going home knowing all of my girlfriends have married or moved away. During the war, I had more in common with the guys than the girls who were getting their hope chest ready. She was determined to keep flying. She decided to get her flight instructor's rating. I thought, I have all this military experience. I'll start teaching. Well, I got my instructor's license, but who wanted to take flying lessons from a girl? No one. Instead, she took a desk job at the local airfield, worked down the line directing and fueling planes, and waited for her chance. If a flight instructor didn't show up, I'd give the lesson. Once I got them in my plane, I usually kept them. My method was different than the men. In the early days, it was a rough business. Men used a lot of swear words and intimidated the students. My idea was to tell you what to do, and you do the best you can. It's sort of a mother's instinct. Maggie did have one final World War II experience before going full throttle into her civilian flying and teaching life. She was at her desk job in August 1945 when the local radio station called to say it appeared that Japan was about to surrender. The local newspaper was on strike and people weren't near their radios during the day, so the enterprising station had an idea. A news drop, so to speak. It hurriedly printed up thousands of leaflets with the news of the pending surrender and hired Margaret to drop them over Fort Wayne. I got to fly right over Main Street, she says, over the factories. I was flying real low, only about 100 feet, almost below some of the buildings. It must have been some sight in that Indiana community, a small plane piloted by a woman at treetop level, papering the town with the news that the war is over.